Blog Talk Radio.
It's okay, take your time.
When life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes. So write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast, and it is a great Wednesday evening for episode number 307. And this is Stephen Zimmer broadcasting to you live out of Lexington, Kentucky. Joining me tonight, two of my main partners in crime here coming out of parts unknown in Tennessee, the one, the only, Daniel Dark. And joining us very shortly in progress will be the amazing, the vivacious, the wonderful Holly Marie Phillippe. So hello, Daniel. Get ready to rock and roll.
I'm ready, man. Hopefully it'll be a beautiful night tonight.
It is. And Holly is with us. Just joined us just about a second ago here. There she is. There, Holly.
I was right on time.
Yeah, you're right on time. Right on time. But, yes, we're going to have a great show tonight. We actually have two guests. So we're going to have a little double trouble for you all tonight. It's going to be a lot of fun, and the topics are going to be very interesting. So get ready for a lot of fun there. The chat room is open. Sandy Linder has already entered the chat room. So, yeah, join us. We're going to have a good time and definitely get a lot of good discussion in. But, yeah, first of all, we're going to give you some updates on stuff with the press and the convention, of course, and had a few interesting things happen. One on the press side, the amazing Aaron Christopher Drown, award-winning author and artist, has a new short story collection called The Gods Must Clearly Smile coming out in April, and we did the cover reveal for that. And everybody who has seen that can vouch for me when I say that it is an excellent, excellent cover. So if you get a chance to check out the Seven Star Press channels, definitely look for that cover. It is just gorgeous. And, again, it's for the short story collection, The Gods Must Clearly Smile. And then we also have some stuff coming up this weekend with Mr. John Pike. I look for a cover reveal happening this Saturday. I believe, Holly, it's going to be on the show Back of the Cereal Box as we are planning it.
Yep.
Is that correct?
8 o'clock in the morning Saturday, so I don't know how much a wake-up be, but I'll be there.
On video, yeah. John wants to do a video cover
only
reveal.
Only for
so
John Pica.
Yeah, no kidding. So, yeah, we're going to do a cover reveal.
I told him that.
Reveal.
Only him could get me out of bed that early.
And, yeah, especially on a Saturday. That's definitely one of the days that Holly and I like to not have – too much in the early morning as far as alarms. We usually do some work on Saturday, but yeah, we don't like to necessarily start too early. So it's going to be interesting, but it should be a fun
one.
The cover art's beautiful. Yeah, the cover art is beautiful, so it's going to be another good one. And then coming up early next week, we will have another one from yours truly. This one for a print release. So that's all I'm going to say about it right now. And, oh, yeah, I did finish a new novella.
Hold on. Hold on before you go on. I want to tell everybody they want to tune in as to check out Back to the Cereal Box on YouTube with John Pica. And you could join us and grab your favorite sugary, lovely childhood cereal to eat. You got to eat cereal while you watch the show. We're going to be eating cereal. I don't know which one I'm going to be eating yet. It'll be a surprise. You have to tune in.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Lucky Charms.
Yeah, I keep joking that I'm going to go on Amazon and order a box of my favorite childhood sugared cereal called Quisp. You remember Quisp?
Yeah.
And it's Quisp with a Q.
You need to, but, and you need to join me and eat your Quisp.
Yeah, that was legendary when I was a kid, and they still sell it, at least on Amazon. Maybe they do in some grocery stores in other parts of the country, but it is still being made, so I may have to do that sometime. But John's show is great.
Daniel,
and, yeah,
I'm
like,
trying to encourage him.
Yeah, John's show is great. Yeah, but 8 a.m., I agree with Sandy. 8 a.m. on a Saturday feels a bit early for marketing success. That's absolutely – I absolutely agree with you,
well,
Sandy.
Well, I'd say people watch the show after it's recorded, you know, but some people are up that early. John, he gets up early every day. I know Gene Rowley gets up at like at crack ass of dawn every day, like at 6 a.m., you know.
Yeah.
Well, some people
see,
just
8
do.
8 o'clock is right after the cartoons go off on Saturday morning.
Yep.
Go off?
What's that?
You didn't know that? 8 a.m. is when the cartoons go off on the TV. At, you know, that's the end of their shows is 8 o'clock.
Seriously?
So you're coming on right after the cartoons.
Really? God, they used to be on till like, what, 11 o'clock when we were kids?
Yeah, 10, 11 when we were kids, yeah. Ha! So that's
like
a little early.
8 o'clock from 6 to 8 or something like that is when they're on now.
Huh.
Well, I'll be. You learn something every day.
That is cool. That is cool. See, neat things you learn on the Star Chamber show. There you go, folks. That's some of the benefits of listening. And and Sandy, I am going to get your question in here in just a second. I do want to give a couple more news updates. I did, yours truly, did finish a novella first draft of a manuscript over the last month. Started on February 6th and finished on March the 7th. And, yeah, it's a nice about 31,000-word novella set in the Raiden Valkyrie Ragnar Stormbringer universe, but a completely different area that has not been explored yet in any of the books or stories, completely different protagonist. And I can't wait to talk in more detail about it. I got to take another week or two to polish it up and get it off to the editor. And but that's I'm really, really happy with that one. And then we also, and Holly, I probably want to comment on this, but we've had, of course, as always, every week, Imaginarium's programming it just keeps growing, getting better and better and better. There's a gaming page up. It's got a list of a lot of games being, of course, the Game Room's hosted by Bloat Games. Josh Palmer is going to be in there, and he's coordinating a lot of the scheduled games.
Hold on.
We've got the first wave up.
Yeah, and I do want to say about that, on Saturday night, I'm trying to pull it up here, on Saturday night, there's going to be a championship in the game hall. I'm trying to find it here. What was I wanting, Steve? Doggone it.
I am not sure. I'm not sure what you're
okay,
wanting.
Okay, here it is. The fourth annual list-off championship. There's a $100 prize pool. A trivia game that plays like Uno meets Trivial Pursuit. You can learn the game in minutes. It's the fourth year in a row that the list of champions will be held at Imaginarium. Prizes for all players, a cash prize for the winner, and that's going to be Saturday at Imaginarium from 8 to 10.
All right. So
that's awesome.
After
very cool.
After all the panels and everything, you can – still get, you know, your libation on and still have time to go play.
Yeah.
That is cool.
And there'll be films going on. There'll be entertainment going on. I mean, there's going to be something going on constantly, you know.
Right.
You never have an excuse to be bored.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And, yeah, I'm really excited about what's coming up with the gaming. And then over on the programming side, we just today added 11 new writing workshops and three more indie film ones. Just a few days before that, we had added a batch of workshops as well. So there is a lot of new programming added to the already big list of programming on there. It just keeps getting better and better and better. So put a word or two in about the all of that, Holly, because I know you've been knee-deep in that.
And what?
Put the panel and workshop programming.
What? I was talking to Sandy.
Whole bunch of new workshops up on the site this last few days. 11 today,
Lord
11,
help us.
14 today alone, and then about 6-7 or so the other day. So, yeah, it's growing fast.
Yeah. And I have more. I do want to touch on two of the premium workshops. These are going to be premium. You have a little fee with these because of the things going on. And the first one is the short story marathon. I guess it's how Sandy Linder, she is, she's actually going to host this, and it's actually going to be on that Thursday. We don't normally start programming, you know, till Friday, but this is going to be held on Thursday because it's going to run 3.5 hours. We have vendors set up, early setup is on Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. This workshop will run from 5 p.m. until 8:30 p.m. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. It'll be a $42 charge. However, you will get to print, well, you will get to publish your neat story that's going to come from this marathon into an anthology that will be published by Seven Star Press, and the proceeds will go to help Imaginarium. And Sandy said she's going to start like a 20-minute presentation, you know, about what we're doing, give you the takeaways from it. You'll learn marathon writing. You'll have a creativity kickstart for the weekend. You'll have a complete short story in hand that'll be published, and you'll have an endorphin rush of the highest magnitude. And she said the theme is going to be your imagination is the foundation. So that's a little bit. So look on, you know, keep looking for that and think about coming in early so you could participate then and that on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is going to be by Barbara Evers. And she touched on this last year, and a lot of people really like this, is about taking the assessment about writing, the writing process based on the Myers-Briggs type indicator. And then there's a MBTI assessment for yourself or your character. And then you will participate in writing exercises. And it's going to be an expanded workshop. So it'll be $35 per person because she has to pay for every person to take the assessment. And we're going to do this on Friday starting at 1:15 p.m. It's going to be a 3-hour. But afterward then, you know, she will come and talk to you about your assessment. She will also be expanded for when you go home from the conference. She's going to look over your stuff and be there for you. So it's going to be really in-depth. And that's going to be two that Stephen will be adding to the website for me. But watch out for those two premium workshops.
Yep. Those will be up before Friday and active because those will definitely be part of this week's email newsletter.
Because they're
going to
fill up.
Yes. And,
yeah, they're
now
definitely
going
to fill up. So.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for that. And I'm going to have to head over to the sponsors because we're getting close to our guest call-in time. And this week we have the amazing Sandy Linder, the Genre Blender, and Per Bostet Publications. And so I'm going to give you first a great spot from Sandy. Listen to it and definitely join in on this. This is a neat project to connect with Sandy and interact with her and everything with her creative world. So check this out, and then we'll give you a little bit about Per Bostet. So first, Sandy Linder.
Do you want to continue creative conversations every day? Author Sandy Linder invites you to join her community on the alternative social platform, Locals. Join Sandy Says Read at locals.com and support a creative community. And just like a drug dealer, she's offering the first month for free with promo code READ. get access to fun, creative content, book news and reviews, and share opinions that don't randomly get canceled. Use code READ to join Sandy Says Read on Locals today.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Really, really appreciate it. And definitely, yeah, check out Sandy on the new platform. And very, very cool stuff. And then also for Perbusted Publications. Perbusted Publications is a small press based in the Louisville metro area, specializing in speculative fiction and other outside-the-box books. With over 30 titles in print and ebook formats and a handful of audiobooks, Perbusted offers a little bit of everything. Explore post-World War II England with 11-year-old Sylvie and Edelweiss for Elizabeth, the sequel to Andrea Gilbey's Bottle Tops for Battleships. Or dive into the thrilling world of Karma and Crime, a new supernatural mystery by J. Paul Burroughs. You can find these titles and more at perbustetpublications.com at Amazon, or you can find the press in person at regional events such as the Imaginarium Convention in July. Perbustet Publications, where timeless tales unfold. Thank you to Teely Harris, Marion Allen, Sarah Marion, the triumvirate, as I call them. Fantastic, fantastic folks. And so I'm going to go right over to our call-in tonight. We have two guests tonight, and I've got one online, so I am going to just start this, but I am going to give the full introduction because I want to make sure that we give you a thorough introduction of tonight's guests, and this is going to be a great one. So, one of our guests tonight is an award-winning author. Karen F. Williams holds degrees in media studies, philosophy, clinical social work, and is a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. And her 2019 novel is The Crow Flies, and 2017 novella, Meeting Miss Roman, were finalists for the Golden Crown Literary Society Awards. And, of course, there's also Coyote Blues, which we're going to be talking about quite a bit tonight. And joining Karen tonight, of course, coming all the way from the West Coast, yes. And this is going to be, this is exciting. This is another award-winning author, also editor and musician. And she is known for in her writing of the award-winning book, Light at the End of the Tunnel, a memoir. Fantastic book. And, of course, she's had a storied career in all kinds of things, media and marketing and music, and just worked with a lot of very big projects. And of course, I'm speaking of the one, the only, Sally Ann Monty. So now I've got the microphone on, and welcome to the show. Your line is on.
I love you, Stephen Zimmer.
There she is. That's Sally Ann.
Oh, yes. I'm so happy. Hello. I can't contain myself.
Wait, am I supposed to be on mute? Should I shut up now?
No. I'm watching for. It looks like Karen may still be calling in, but I'll be bringing her in as soon as she does, because I just saw one line. I didn't know if both of you were on it, but I wanted to go ahead and get our discussion going.
Is Karen now with you? Is Karen with you?
We're bi-coastal. She's going to call in separately.
Oh,
okay.
That's what I thought.
Did you want me to pull it all together, or you guys?
No. We could do it either way. However, you plan to do it. Absolutely, we could have a do it absolutely that way. And just great
it's
to have you again.
Show.
Yes, it's your show.
I'll just sit here worrying about how I'm going to live up to that introduction. How about that?
Well, we've missed you, so it's just great to have you on tonight.
Oh,
so, exciting enough.
Great to be here. Miss you guys too.
Holly can tell you this week I've started even sing the Bidet Bidet song, getting ready for the show, so getting in the spirit.
He was
You're
getting in, and then we were talking about earlier about the first time that we met, and I said, I can't wait to lift her off the ground again. So.
And for those of you that
we need to get.
I just told that story today to Karen, and I don't know that she believed me, so you'll have to repeat it when she gets here.
Oh, yes. And for those of you listeners that don't know the Bidet story, this was a pandemic song that Sally had come up with when there was the great toilet paper shortage that was hitting everybody in the country. And she wrote a song called Bidet Bidet, and it's catchy. I know it's going to be a hit as soon as Sally Ann puts it out there commercially, and it is great. But, yeah, it's something you never forget. You never forget. So that's the story behind the song.
I haven't forgotten it, Steve. You keep reminding me.
Oh, it is classic.
That's his favorite song from the pandemic, period.
It is, period.
I'm going to send you a recording, I promise.
It's even more than all of my favorite heavy metal bands that I love and all that what they did during the pandemic.
Gosh.
This even exceeds that. So yeah.
You know what? It was a parody on Matt Davis, "Baby Baby Don't Get Hooked on Me." That's what it was.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah,
so Holly, where do we want to start with Sally Ann? Because I know we're going to get into some shape-shifting fun here. So what do you want to do?
Well, for first off, give them a rundown, Sally Ann, of what you got new going on. And I think you have something you'd like to read for us.
Sure. Okay. Well, I've been writing a poetry book for several years now. But considering it took me 23 years to write The Light at the End of the Tunnel book, which, thank you, in 2019 it got Imaginarium recognition. That was really great. But anyway, this book is a bunch of years in the making, and it's a poetry book, but it tells a story. So each poem is really more like a chapter than a poem, a standalone poem. And it's pretty hot and steamy and angsty and gives you, you know, hits you all in the right spots. Pain, suffering, and
nice.
The name of the book. The book is Poems and Provocations, Love's Pain, and Pleasure. And so I've been writing these poems. The problem is I can't stop writing the poems, and I'm like having 300 poems now, so of course not going to all be in that book. So I have to stop writing them long enough to do something with it. So I'm working on that, and I'm hoping to release it in December of this year.
Awesome.
And that's... that's my literary stuff. Other than that, I've been playing a lot of music, taking some voice lessons and getting some coaching from my brother, who's one of the best singers I've ever heard. And so that's been a fun journey. And I've never sung a note prior to January 1st of 2020 on a dare. So it's been a journey. I encourage everyone to find their voice. It's in there, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
I was loving your videos during the pandemic,
yeah.
And when we were all locked up.
Oh,
your
so
your
good.
Singing
so
videos
good.
Was fantastic.
The best, yeah. We watched them all the time.
They pop up and I'm like, oh my God.
Oh yeah, I bet they do in your memories.
Yeah, that's
oh,
true.
Yeah. Usually at 2 a.m. when I can't go to sleep.
Well, I have some good news. I had some good news. Karen is on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and bring Karen
all
in
right.
Just so she can hang out with us on the air here as we delve into this part of the show. So, Karen,
hey,
welcome. Your microphone is on.
Okay. Is this Steven?
Yes, it is. Hello.
Okay. Hey, guys.
Welcome back.
Holly,
welcome back.
Daniel
hi,
there,
Karen.
Yep.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Karen.
Are we on the air yet?
Yes, yes,
we are.
And I gave you a grand introduction early. When I introduced the early part with Sally Ann, but Sally Ann could vouch for me.
I'm sorry, I missed
it
that.
I certify it happened. I heard it was my.
It did
interview.
Happen. Welcome, and it's great to have you back on the show. And we were just getting underway. Yeah, with the Sally Ann, and but fantastic
Daniel,
to have you on the
Daniel
show.
Daniel Dark's in here somewhere. Daniel Dark.
He's lurking.
Yes, I am.
Yes, it's great to be back. I've missed everyone.
Glad to have you back.
Yes. So, Sally Ann, yes, you were about to get into some of the poetry, I believe, right? Is that what we got on?
Oh,
on tap here?
Sure, let's get me out of the way because really, Cat Williams is a star. Honestly, this woman is a best-selling writer. She should be. Her work is fantastic. Anybody
yes.
who buys a book and doesn't like it, send me an email. I'll pay you for that book because she's a great author. So I'll just I'll now continue with a hot and steamy poem that will be part of my book coming out in December of 2022, Poems of Provocation, Love's Pain, and Pleasure. And this one for tonight is, and I wrote this a while ago, it's called Shape Shifted, which I believe we are going to delve into with Karen. So here we go, Shape Shifted,
yes.
Sally A. Monte. What can I say to you that I haven't already said to you in, well, you know the rest, and still it flows. Voracious, gluttonous, shrouded in perpetuation, my love for you, enormous. You come to me over and over. You, the waves crashing on the beach. Me, your shoreline, splayed, waiting, ready, soaking wet. Treacherous, violent, forbidden, unrelenting, nature's force and fury pulsating within us. And through the interminable distance between us, still we merge. Like a gale-force wind, a hurricane on course to a conspired destination, I come for you. Whipping wildly, screaming your name over and over in the muffled, thunderous roar, my tears pouring down, torrential. You, my greatest love, as essential to my existence as my human need to breathe. Here I sit in my life away from you. You coursing through my veins, raging and ravaging me from the inside out. Me acutely aware of you on a cellular level, where energy and passion collide. You, my nuclei, consumed by you, shape-shifted.
Wow.
Nice. Wow, that is fantastic.
Love it.
Yeah, love it.
We're all shape-shifting occurs on a molecular level. So it happens where all your passion lies and where you get all torn up inside, and that's when things shift. Now, how far we take it, I leave that to the expert, Karen Williams.
Ah, wow. You leave me flummoxed.
Or I can sing a song while you think about it.
How can I top that?
Yeah, Sally can, you know, sing us a tune while you ponder.
Sing us a tune.
Probably wind up in the same place as the song.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know Karen wants to talk about Coyote Blues and how that, there's a book about shape shifting, and it's a great book, so maybe start there.
Well, I guess it does all take place on a molecular level, so
So talk about, Karen, your shapeshifter is called a were-coyote?
A were-coyote.
So what inspired this? Yeah.
Yeah, that was my twist on the traditional werewolf trope. I guess it goes back to the old adage, write what you know. I don't personally know any wolves, but I do know plenty of coyotes. I'm between New York City and the Berkshires of Massachusetts, but here in Massachusetts I have several acres, and when I bought the house, there was already a resident pack here. So we kind of all live together, and I've gotten to know them very well. So I keep trail cameras, especially during the writing of the book, I kept trail cameras up to record them in the dark. But even though coyotes are considered... Huh?
That is neat.
Well,
that you were actually, watching them and while you're writing the book to get visual inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they're always considered crepuscular hunters, favoring hunting at twilight, whether it's, dawn or dusk.
Mm-hmm.
But they can also be very active in the afternoon, as long as they don't think they're being watched. So many days I was able to just sit in the woods and watch them. And the other thing with coyotes is that they prefer to live and sleep out in the open. They only use dens, you know, primarily when they're whelping pups. So, yeah, during the writing of the novel, I had ample opportunity to study their behaviors and watch first my resident pack. And then in the fall, we always get a lot of what are called dispersal coyotes. Those are usually the young males bursting from their birthplaces, you know, to go off and find and establish their own territories. Unfortunately, dispersals have the highest mortality rate because with more brawn than brains and more testosterone than experience and without the protection of the wiser parents, you know, they're easy targets for trappers and sport hunters, you know. And then deep in the winter, we'll get the occasional transient coyote, the lone wolf, so to speak, usually an elderly animal that's been pushed off and, you know, is traveling to points unknown. So, yes, you know, they just really inspired. Without them, I never would have written this particular novel. And Holly, I remember from our last conversation, I think you lost a dog to a coyote.
I lost a pig.
A pig? Wow.
I lost my little pot-belly pig named Pig.
Oh, my God.
A pack of, yes. I was like 8 months pregnant with my daughter, and my son Noah, who's now almost 27, he was a little feller then, you know, he was in bed, and I was home alone with him and being this, you know, out to here pregnant, and I didn't have a gun at that time or anything, and a whole pack of them come up into my yard of coyotes, and
wow.
I had this little, like, chicken fence, you know, around our front yard area there. And little pig, he wasn't very big yet, you know. He was probably about a teenage pig. And we named him Pig. His name was Pig. But, yeah, they actually rooted it underneath the fence and drug him out. And it was awful. And I called the police, and they're like, well, honey, there's really nothing we could do. Do you got any firecrackers? And I'm like, yeah. And they said, well, light those and throw it. And I said, I am not opening up my front door while they're in a rage here, you know, killing my pig and me being 8 months pregnant.
Yeah.
I said, you know, that's probably not smart. So, I mean, I just had to let it happen. And it was awful. I was yelling at them out the window, but yeah, it was horrific, but you know, they were hungry. I understand it's animal instinct, but it was horrific.
Except when it happens, you know, I remembered the story when you tell me. I thought it was a dog, but awful.
Shit,
and
pig.
Yeah, I mean, you know, end of the day, you know, we're all out there just trying to make a living, and you know, with the animals too, it's just, you know, they're hunger driven. And but I'll tell you one thing, which I keep too in case I ever need it, is, you know, they sell the little horn in a can.
And
that works. In fact, there was a woman on the news recently, and she and her husband, they watched a coyote snatch their chihuahua, and the wife ran in the house, and she got the horn and ran after the coyote, and as soon as she, you know, wonk, wonk, whatever, it dropped the dog and went off, and the dog was okay. But, you know, loud noises are always pretty effective.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a 3-foot fence. Yeah, go on.
I was going to interrupt with a short story.
Okay.
But now I forgot what I was going to say, so I'll just shut up.
It'll come back to you, Sally. Give it a few minutes. It'll come back around.
Right.
It's coming. Let me spit it out before it goes. Wait, come back. Okay. Now here it is. We have javelinas here, and they're pack animals.
You have what?
There's a lot.
What do you have?
They're javelinas. They're wild boars pigs with tusks, and they will impale you if you encounter them, especially if they have babies present. And they're all over Sedona. And so we are on a hike, a moonlight hike, and the guide says, okay, well, if we see javelinas, we have to run. They can only run for 150 yards. And she told a story about how she outran the javelinas because they were going to get her. And I said, you know, what happens if you got to keep going. Otherwise, when they recover, they're going to come get you anyhow. So remember that. Do you ever encounter a javelina? You got 150 yards before you're, you know.
In other words, you run like hell. That's what you do.
Back to you, Karen.
Yeah, well, so that's where the coyotes came from. So instead of a werewolf, yes, I went with a werecoyote. And, you know, they're also a lot more like us than wolves are. And probably because they're, well, you describe like a pack taking your pig, but, you know, typically they're singular hunters, and they really feed on very small, I mean, usually it's mice, squirrels, frogs, lots of insects.
Rabbits,
you know,
whatever.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so they hunt alone, and for that reason, they don't rely on that highly organized structure of a large pack, you know, the way wolves do, where everyone has a specific role, you know. So sometimes, you know, you'll see, you know, father, mother, baby, and last year's offspring that's now an adolescent and serving as nanny. Or sometimes you'll see, like, three females and their older children. So their families vary, you know, very much like human families as compared with wolves.
And that very much could have been the case with the piggy, you know. It could have been a mama with, you know, her older children, you know. I don't know.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite possible.
And
so do your werecoyotes, do they behave in the book? Do you treat them with, like, the werewolf lore? You know, like sticking to the silver bullets, the full moon. Do you keep all that, or is it different?
Well, it's a little different. You know, also when we talk about coyotes, and I know Sally wanted to get into, you know, shapeshifters and, you know, skinwalkers, but, you know, especially out there in southwestern, you know, American Indian folklore, you know, southwestern folklore. Mm-hmm. You know, the coyote is a very popular archetype. You know, the trickster, right?
Right.
You know, the coyote is a typical trickster. And I think is, you know, the case with all mythical narratives, especially speculative fiction, you know, high fantasy and so forth. The stuff Stephen writes, it makes good use of all the popular archetypes. You know, all those universal symbols of both human and animal nature that hail from our ancestral past and come to life in what Joseph Campbell called the monolith or the hero's adventure. And, you know, in his introduction to A Hero with a Thousand Faces, you know, he writes that something to the effect that, you know, a hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder where fabulous forces are there encountered and a decisive victory, you know, must be won. Of course, when it comes to writing urban fantasy, which is really what I write, the hero doesn't have to travel too far because those fabulous forces and supernatural wonders really make their way into the ordinary present-day world, you know. But either way, you know, those common archetypes are the hero, the wise old sage who mentors the hero. Then you always have the guardian who protects the hero and the villain or the shadow without which we wouldn't need the hero. and then there's the herald whose role it is to bring news that will stir the hero to action. And as important as the rest is the trickster who is often a shapeshifter, whose job it is to sabotage the hero at every turn. So the interesting thing with Coyote Blues and the protagonist Were-Coyote is that she is both ousted trickster and the hero who must trick the villain in order to save a woman and her child. So that was my twist on things. And it seems for a long time in the book that she's really one of a kind. So in the prologue, we're kind of introduced to her at birth and up until the, you know, the college years. So Riley Dawson, she was actually found on the Appalachian Trail in Massachusetts by hikers right after birth, abandoned, still with her placenta and a tail. She had a tail. And
wow.
Sometimes, well, you know, the truth is that all vertebrates do have a tail.
Start out, right? Right.
You know, we all start out with tails, and then, you know, it eventually recedes during embryonic development to form the coccyx. But on rare occasions, a baby is born with a fleshy appendage containing nerves and muscle, and rarer still, there may actually be bone, like up to 5 vertebrae, resulting in a true vestigial tail that can contract and move and who knows, maybe even wag if it was left to itself.
If they're happy.
So that was the case with Riley, and the tail was surgically removed. She's adopted by very wealthy parents in Manhattan, and life is good. She lives a very privileged life until the age of 17 when her her tail grows back. So she does not know why or how she is what she is, and life becomes pretty awful. You know, it's a life of loneliness and everything until she is sort of adopted by one of her professors, who learns and later guards her secret. And they end up 20 years later. Chapter 1 opens 20 years later. So she's now a successful psychotherapist in practice with her former professor, Peggy Spencer. And there are just 3 people who know and keep her secret, and life is fine until her long-lost love shows up for therapy. And it turns out that Fiona is... now the mother of a 10-year-old child, and she is married to a narcissist bordering on a psychopath. And by the way, narcissists, you know, they're trending these days. All the true crime stories, the Inventing Anna, Lady Gaga in the Gucci movie, House of Gucci.
I haven't got to see it yet, but I want to. Yes.
We did see the Anna series. Yeah, we saw that one.
Yeah. Fascinating. And I actually, you know, my back, well, I'm actually a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, which is a volunteer position for the Department of Environmental Protection. But aside from writing, which I've been doing all my life, I published my first book in my 30s, and it was close to 30 years ago. But in terms of my career, I was a clinical social worker. So I was in private practice and with the school system. But when I started out, right out of graduate school, I was hired by a private psychiatrist as a forensic social worker. So basically, it was a position doing group therapy with the criminally insane. And you know, when I first took the position, it was like, wow, yeah, it's going to be like Jodie Foster with Hannibal Lecter. It was like, you know, we all romanticize, psychopaths, and it was like, wow, this is going to be really fascinating. And then, you know, it didn't take long for that to wear off and say, oh my God, this is awful, you know, like these people they don't have a conscience, you know. So anyway.
True.
I digress, but so anyway, so Riley is now the psychotherapist, and now has, you know, when this woman walks in and she hasn't seen her in 20 years, and, you know, it's just her, all the rules of the client-therapist relationship, you know, go out the window, and her world is turned upside down, and she has to find a way to really get rid of this man who is definitely like a family annihilator in the making. And as you may not know, the typical profile of a family annihilator is a white guy, 40s, 50s, upstanding member of the community, almost always, you know. So, you know, people mm-hmm. like never see it coming. It's like, oh, I used to see him walking his dog, or he was a really nice guy. He always waved on his way to work, you know. And then suddenly the whole family has been murdered. So this is kind of, you know, in the making, and she has to figure out a way to do away with this guy. And she knows she can't just rip his throat out, because that happened once before, and some innocent coyotes ended up being trapped and killed for her sins, you mm-hmm. know. So it's like, oh, my God, if I just attack and rip this guy's throat out,
cops,
the rangers, everyone's going to be on the lookout and be, you know, shooting
mm-hmm.
or trapping, you know, every coyote in the area. So that becomes her dilemma. But in terms of writing the character, you know, it's I my whole life, just having come from a big animal family, like I can't remember a time when we didn't have multiple dogs and cats and turtles and snakes and birds and everything else, as I do now. I just, you know, my wish, like as a child, if you said, you know, if you had one wish, well, now I wouldn't be that stupid and I'd ask for money probably. But then it was like, yeah, my wish would be to be able to get into the mind and body of any animal. That's what I always wanted, just to try to figure them out, you know, to know how they see life, and who wouldn't want to do that, you know, just spend 24 hours body hopping, right?
That'd be
like,
awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was like a real opportunity to try to really, pretend to pretend to be
right.
A coyote. And I can even read you a little something if you'd like.
Sure.
Please. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me grab something. It was a little condensed version of a chapter, but just to kind of convey that experience. This is kind of early in the book, and Raleigh is about to take off because this woman has come back into her life, and she realizes her husband is, you know, quite dangerous, and you know, he's harboring his wife and a child. And they've just moved into the area because the narcissist husband, Jim, has inherited this old homestead from his equally narcissistic uncle. So here it goes. Riley had spent so many years loathing this lycanthropic affliction that denied her a normal life that she often failed to appreciate the glory of it. But it was exhilarating, this raw strength and power, this incongruous state of being elevated to a lower life form, if that made any sense. There was an exaltation in the lessening, a paradox only another shapeshifter could understand. Not that Riley knew any, but it would have been nice to exchange notes with someone who understood what it was like to transcend the wrappings of humanity. Riley stood in the driveway and gave herself a good shake, shedding those wrappings like a dog shaking off the rain. Her fur retained the blonde and golden brown hues of her human hair, and her eyes were still their usual shade of amber, but they saw the world differently now. There was a lucidity to life, a clarity of vision, a crystal clear wisdom that eluded her in human form. She threw her head back, howling a request for the coyotes who shared her home. A moment later, Gadget answered from the distance, his long, deep wail joined by Widget's yips that rose and fell in pitch. Any person listening to the frenzied ululations of those two animals would swear they were hearing 10 coyotes, maybe more. But it was only an auditory illusion, known as the Bogest effect, created by a wide variety of symphonic sounds distorting as they passed through the air. Riley likened it to the tactics of a small group of warriors making a lot of noise in order to fool the opposition into thinking they were large in number. Riley mentally mapped their coordinates. Later, she'd catch up with them. But right now, she had some snooping to do. Negotiating the dense woods was an option, but desolate roads, trails, open fields were always a coyote's preferred means of quick travel. She took off then, probably reaching 30 miles per hour along the shoulder of the road. It was incredible moving at this speed, the ultimate runner's high, and she might have maintained it for a bit if not for a car approaching. She heard it before she saw the glare of the headlights and ducked into the brushwood, panting to catch her breath and cool down. When the car passed, she sprinted again until she reached the open field and stopped under the star-filled sky to get a good whiff of the world. I'm sorry, I was saying woof, but woof. To get a good whiff of the world. Her nose twitched, pinpointing the source of all scents with amazing accuracy. She loved having this canine nose, especially the slits on the sides of her nostrils that enabled her to inhale and exhale simultaneously and pocket away unfamiliar smells for further processing, like the faint odor of diesel fuel coming from the northwest. She crossed the field then, trotting down a narrow trail to the creek. During early spring, the heavy rains and meltwater would have made this rivulet impassable without getting soaked. But by midsummer, the water level was low enough that the flat tops of river rocks protruded like stepping stones. Riley leapt from rock to rock across the wide channel, then scrambled up the bank and pushed her way through the brush until she stood in what was once a cow pasture. Ryegrass grew high around crooked and rotting fence posts, rusted barbed wire hanging loosely or having completely fallen away. In the distance, the homestead came into view, white and picture-perfect with its softly glowing windows. To the left of the house, something shined, but it wasn't until Riley was halfway across the pasture that she realized it was the chrome grill of a big-rigged truck. That explained the smell of diesel fuel. Daddy's home, she thought. Riley paused to orient herself, listening to the surrounding sounds, the steady murmur of the creek behind her, the bellowing of frogs and hooting owls. The sharp bark of a fox rang out, and the grass softly whistled in her ears as this cool summer breeze swept across the expanse of land, and from somewhere came the faint drone of a television. A deep growl rumbled in her chest as she hurried through the overgrown pasture, her eyes blinking against the switches of grass whipping her face. By the time she emerged, the place had lost all its charm. White paint was peeling from the clapboard. The barn and outbuildings to the right were ramshackle. Stacked in front of one was a pile of old tires, and here and there sat rusted barrels with heaps of junk. The driveway, too, could have used a few tons of fresh gravel. Riley navigated the muddy ruts that still had held water from the morning's rain, then made her way around the porch and up to the windows to get a good look at this Jim Barrett guy and figure out what was going inside that old farmhouse. That's it.
Wow.
Wow.
Nice.
That's
fantastic.
Good. And that's just a taste. So, yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
That was just a taste. That'll wet somebody's whistle there.
Yeah. Yeah, so that starts the challenge between Riley and this abusive husband. There's also, so you know, the three themes in the book or shape-shifting psychology, because there's, you know, a big emphasis and exploration of narcissism in the book, and religion.
Right.
And a lot of people.
I was
going to
ask you about the religious aspect.
Yeah. What about it?
Mm-hmm. How did you tie that in with, like, within the shape-shifting world?
Yeah, because it's usually not, like, a common kind of thing.
Common,
you know,
yeah, a common thread, yeah.
With supernatural.
Well,
I guess it goes back to the animals, but, for one, I was raised in the church. My grandfather was a minister and missionary. And my father, even though he was an advertising executive, had to drag us all off to Sunday service and Sunday school. And with all that, we were, as I said before, a huge animal family. And it always bothered me, you know, if we lost a pet and I'd go to church and say something to the Sunday school teacher like, you know, do you think, you know, Binky's in heaven? And, you know, inevitably I'd get the same thing that, no, Karen, Binky isn't in heaven. Animals don't go to heaven. But there are spiritual animals in heaven. There are the lion laying with the lamb, but not any animals you've known on earth, you know. And it just really, like, at such an early age, by the time I was six, I was, like, so turned off to Christianity because it was like, God, you know, all these older, you know, pagan religions, they, you know, American Indians, I mean, there was this great respect for the land, for animals, right? I mean, it was...
Right, right.
You know, they were almost seen as, in a way, you know, peers or comrades, and here, Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then later when I began in college as a philosophy student and being introduced to the writings of, you know, all these famous Catholic philosophers like Descartes, who was like the worst. He was just the worst for animals, you know, and the worst for Christianity in terms of how they saw animals, which was that they are just incapable of thought and emotion, that animals are nothing more than organic machines. So you can, if you want to do vivisection, you want to cut them open, you want to eat them, you can beat anything you want
That's
to do
horrific.
To them. It just, yeah, you know, just knock your heart out, you know, because they really are impervious to pain and suffering, you know. And on top of that, they're soulless. So they're not going to heaven.
Right.
Just treat them any way, you know, you want. So that was a big turnoff. So I think, you know, in the book, speaking again about archetypes, that the character who becomes the guardian is this very mysterious Reverend David Cortez, who looks like a young Antonio Banderas, that kind of a guy. And he's just very kind, but very watchful and very mysterious throughout the book. And so I think I, you know, and considering that the main character is half human and half animal, I think that I originally came up with his character so it would give me a platform for discussing these ideas, you know, about the nature of the soul and that between, you know, humans and animals. And what's also interesting is that while I was writing Coyote Blues, I happened upon an article in the science section of the New York Times. You might remember the Chimera from Greek mythology. That was the hybrid creature, right? It was part goat, part lion, serpent, maybe man. I don't know. It was just a bunch of things. So this article was on what scientists today refer to as chimeras. And this is what they call lab animals with two distinct DNA profiles, say a mouse injected with human stem cells or a pig embryo modified with human DNA, the purpose of which is to one day perform pig-to-human heart transplants without the body rejecting them, you know. But apparently this is causing, like right now, this is causing an ongoing uproar among religious leaders who argue that if a chimera is part human, even 5%, then does it have a soul? And if so, do we have the moral right to kill and harvest its organs? I mean, this is actually, these arguments are going on. So,
right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So reading that piece was really timely. And it got me to thinking, you know, as these, esoteric things usually do, you know, but really I thought, well, if a mythical werewolf did exist, it would be a chimera, half human, half animal, a single organism with two separate DNA profiles. So I thought my readers would find that interesting. And the Reverend Cortez's character, aside from being, he ended up being really integral to the plot, more so than I thought originally, because he might also be a shapeshifter. But he became a platform, you know, for exploring those ideas. And if you like, I can read you a short excerpt from a chapter that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this chapter is way further on, probably three quarters along in the book, and Riley has decided to that she has no choice but to probably commit murder, and understands there's a good chance that she might be murdered in the process. So she has prepared a will. She lives alone, so she can't leave it there, and she doesn't want to leave it with her best friend and partner, Peggy, because that will concern Peggy. Why Riley suddenly has went and got a will. So she decides to bring it to the church, and Peggy attends that church, and Riley has met the Reverend David Cortez socially on occasion. So she just figures that maybe he'll be able to lock it up, you know, and the church is safe, and if anything happens, you know, he can give it to whomever, her lawyer or Peggy. So Riley heads over there. Okay. White clouds appeared to hover just above an arm's reach in the crisp blue sky. The hills beyond the church, a patchwork of orange, red, and yellow leaves. Riley pulled her car around to the back of the rectory to find the Reverend shirtless and chopping wood, his dark, glistening skin soaking up the last rays of the summer sun. Riley got out of the car with a manila envelope and gestured at the wood pile. Getting ready for winter, huh, Reverend? The Reverend raked his fingers through his long black hair and smiled. Comes quickly here in New England, you know. Fast and furious this year, according to the farmer's almanac. He shielded his eyes from the sun, panning the sky and distant hills as if he could actually see winter approaching. I need a favor, Riley said. Do you have a few minutes? Of course. He swung his axe, burying it in a log, then wiped his brow with a forearm. You like apple juice? Riley shrugged. Sure. Then come on in with me and have a glass. I just juiced half a bushel. That's a lot of apples, Riley said. About 60. He snatched a denim shirt from the back of a weathered Adirondack chair and slipped into it as they walked to the door. The living room of the rectory was sparsely furnished but cozy enough, even if it seemed dark coming in from the sun. The wall with the fireplace was entirely fieldstone, the other wall stucco. An amber lamp lit their way, casting a strange light on a large nautical oil painting befitting a seafarer. Riley stopped to squint at the scene as she passed. In a raging ocean, an enormous open-mouthed whale rose from the whitecaps, and thrashing about the stormy waves was a teeny-weeny man, his expression aghast, arms and legs flailing as though he were doing cartwheels on the open sea. Jonah, she guessed, although whether the whale was about to swallow or had just spit him out, she couldn't say for sure. Riley moved on, following the Reverend and the delicious smell of apples into the kitchen. on a long, narrow farm table worn with age, was an impressive juicer, and apples everywhere. Riley suspected there might be another Bible story going on in here. So David pours them apple juice, and he invites her into his office, and they sit together on a couch in the air condition, and they start chatting, and the Reverend mentions an upcoming group, one of his holistic studies groups and another metaphysical Bible study group, and Riley tells him, like she has said before, that she's just really not interested in Christianity or buying into any religion that shows such little respect for nature and animals and sees them as being soulless. So the Reverend responds by saying to her, "Not all Christians believe animals are soulless, Riley. I, for one, don't." He regarded her with a kind smile. "You got to remember that the scriptures, like the Constitution, are subject to interpretation. I've always thought of ministers such as myself as, well, kind of like spiritual attorneys. Put 10 ministers in a room, put 10 lawyers in a room, and you'll get 10 different interpretations of the law, whether it's biblical or secular law. Things get lost in translation, too. For instance, the Bible, in its original language, describes animals as a duality, body and soul, and humans as a trinity, body, soul, and spirit. The spirit, of course, being that part of the eternal soul that gives us free will. I think of the free will as being synonymous with imagination. It's what sets us apart from the animals, to imagine what doesn't yet exist, to create new things and choose whether to use them for good or evil. Think about it. Someone invented a wheelchair while someone else was inventing a torture chamber. You get my drift." Mm-hmm. "I do," Riley said, "but, well, what if it turns out that animals don't have souls? Where would that leave someone who's, like, say, only half human?" The Reverend's face twisted in confusion as though Riley were telling an off-color joke and he was waiting for the punchline. "Half human? I don't understand." "Well, yeah, like, I don't know, Reverend. Say I'm a werewolf." The Reverend seemed to startle at the word. "Werewolf? Yeah, you know, a shapeshifter, a skinwalker. Let's say I'm one of those. Not a bloodthirsty monster, but an innocent freak of nature. What then? Will I disappear into oblivion after I die because I only have half a soul?" The Reverend squirmed a little in his seat, as though it suddenly occurred to him that Riley, the psychotherapist, might be a little nuts. He opened his mouth to speak, mm-hmm. but when nothing came out, he scratched his head as if stimulating his brain to come up with a response. "Gee, Riley, I don't know what to say. I suppose the wolf and human together would make one soul." But he raised his arm back over his head, knocking a knuckle against the Noah's Ark print that hung on the wall over the couch. "Can you make out the scripture that's written along the bottom of this print?" Riley turned in her seat and read it. "For we know that the whole of creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only the creatures, but ourselves also, which have the first fruit of the Spirit, groan within ourselves, waiting for the redemption of our bodies." Romans 8. "That passage," the Reverend said, "makes it clear to me that animals are on some level cognizant of a higher power, of their gratuitous suffering on earth and their longing for redemption. It may not be something they're able to actively contemplate like humans do, but in the silence of their souls, I believe there is an understanding of a cosmic greatness, a greatness vast and deep." "Yes," Riley wanted to scream out. That was exactly what she experienced in Fur. No matter what she was doing, listening to the wind running with the pack sprawled beneath the stars in the field at night, she was always aware of an indefinable truth, a universal principle, a greatness that was, yes, so vast and deep she couldn't name it. It was hard for her coyote mind to translate the particulars to her human brain, impossible for her animal side to effectively put into words. the logistics and linguistics were complicated. But when she walked on all fours, that universal truth was there inside her, cryptic, encoded perhaps, but always connecting her to something greater. She could only describe it as a strange sort of knowing, like knowing you know something, yet not quite sure what it is you know or even how you came to know it, only that you do. A knowledge beyond language. That's how it felt. Kind of like the canine equivalent of a Buddhist achieving nirvana. So that was that was my take on something that maybe animals, that everything that is connected in the world feels.
I always think of us like a giant spider web, that, you know, we're all interconnected because we're all energy. You know, energy cannot be destroyed, so we're all energy. And if you truly, people that say animals don't have a soul have never truly loved an animal.
They haven't loved an animal like our kitties.
We have here.
Oh, I want to jump in this conversation.
You look at their affection towards you.
Oh, yes.
You know they have a soul. You know,
absolutely.
Same way with like a horse or, you know, or anything, a dog or whatever. You see the affection they can show towards you, and they have emotions. They do cry. They do show emotion, and you know they have a soul. You can feel that, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say here, I've had profound experiences. That, you know, people would either believe or not believe, that I have absolutely have experienced, our four-legged family members in a non-physical form. And also, I've stared right into their eyes as they've passed, and I've watched that light go out. And that's, you know, it may be anecdotal, but I was fortunate. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've run into many ministers, pastors, and so forth. I grew up Catholic, and I was fortunate that I grew up with priests that actually steered me toward some of the saints, though, that like Francis of Assisi, who hold a blessing of the animals every October 4th for his feast day, and he referred to animals as his brothers and sisters, and, you know, St. Francis did, and there are many others, like St. Bridget and several other Catholic saints that were very bonded with animals, very much connected with them, and so for me, I mean, it was different. I mean, I always grew up and was brought up even believing in one of the forms of, you know, Catholic faith, they just don't have original sin or free, you know, the same free will that humans do. In other words, I was kind of jealous of them as a kid because I thought they got a free ticket to heaven.
they can do anything they want. They're not held responsible.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be judged, but they don't. that's kind of how I actually grew up. That's kind of my take as a kid and growing up. Mm-hmm. And I'll end this, you know, 'cause I don't want to take up too much of your time, Karen. But when I got older and started to really dig into comparative religions and theology, because I'm fascinated with all kinds of faiths and seeing, you know, common bonds between them and things like that. But I was looking into, you know, specifically about animals, but in the, you know, the creation story, the Hebrew word for the breath of life for both humans and animals is the same word. And most, theologians would suggest that the breath of life is indicative of the soul. And so it always baffles me why it's so hard for so many denominations and even so many parts of Christianity to accept that animals have a soul, because it's right there in, you know, the first book of the Bible. If you look at the actual Hebrew words, and it just baffles me.
It's taken out of context.
Humans too. That so many people say, well, you know, the Bible is divinely inspired, and it was, but you know, it's also part of history, and you know, with all these. Mm-hmm. Dictators and evil people who rule, who have been, you know, you know, you can imagine some guy coming up late at night where all the monks were, you know, by hand, you know, writing the Bible out and
scriptorium.
Over and
so
say,
yes.
You know, this, yep. I don't know, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe the guy caught his wife with another woman and say, you know what, you need to you need to put this line
right.
in there. I mean, you know, who knows? You know, anything to to benefit the you know, whoever is in charge. But, you know, I think with animals, especially with Judaism, Christianity, that it's like, all right, we work these animals to death and we eat them, and now, you know, during the Age of Enlightenment, where we're starting to dissect them and experiment on, that, you know, you can't believe that they have a soul, you know. It's like a way to reconcile what you're doing, you know, those horrible things you're doing with, well, it's a, you know, they don't feel, or they don't have souls, or it's okay. They don't feel pain the way we do. It's like boiling a lobster. We know now how many hundreds of years does it take to know that the most awful death is like being boiled alive. They used to boil people alive, and it could take hours. As long as your head wasn't submerged, you could boil for hours. You know, right? It was considered one of the great torture methods. So,
right.
you know, I think we just need to believe that they are lesser, that they don't feel, that they don't go, we don't have to see them in heaven and feel guilty, like, oh, my God, oh, hide me. Who just walked in? Ah, that was the pig I had, you know, for dinner. Don't let them see me, you know. So, you know, we just have to rationalize. I mean, you know, even recently I was just watching a documentary about, having to do with slavery, but it was journals that were found from this white woman who had raised her kids alongside her house servant, right? So it was a black woman and you know, she worked in the white house, and they both had babies. And, of course, when the black maid's baby reached the age of three, the white woman's white husband came to her and said, all right, darling, the men will be here tonight to take so-and-so's baby. And she said, well, what do you mean? Well, he's going to auction. And, of course, the white wife broke down and was trying to stop them from taking the black woman's baby. And they came and they took the baby. And she writes in her journal how her husband, trying to calm her down and, you know, coddle her, and just said, listen, it's okay. You know, the black woman is crying now, but she'll get over it in a day or two, because, you know, they don't love their babies the way white people do. You know, and it was just a way of saying, all right, well, we buy and sell and trade slaves. So, you know, this is just the time we're living in. And, you know, rather than admitting that we're committing atrocity,
that it's wrong,
we'll just say that, you know, it's like a dog, a goat, or they don't really feel that much toward their babies, you know.
Right.
I guess we just have to do this. You know,
it was justifying it was justifying it, so they didn't have to feel, you know, all the guilt. Yeah.
You know, I'm also belong to a great group called Network for Animals, and they are on the front line now in Ukraine, and you know, trying to bring trucks of food in, and then as they leave, after they drop off the food, they're bringing animals out. And, you know, sometimes people will go on their site and make comments like, well, you know, who cares about animals? Like, people are dying. And it's like, yes, we know. Everyone's trying to help. We're helping the people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, God bless someone else who's going in and also helping to reunite people with their pets. And, you know, and, you know, you talk about love and how some people don't understand it, but my God, you know, when you've loved a cat or a dog, or, and, you know, the thought of having to leave it at the border, having to, you know, it's just awful, you know, to see elderly people and they don't even have a crate for their cat, and the cat's inside their coat, and they're suffering. They hardly have shoes. It's snowing there, and it's just, you know, everything suffers. And that goes back to Romans 8. you know, that the whole of creation groaneth and travaileth in pain on this earth, you know?
Yeah, they're family, and I've read some stories about some cat cafe, it was in Kiev, and the owners are absolutely not leaving no matter what, and they're going to stay and take care of, like, about 20 cats, I think they have, and I mean, that's one of several that I've read.
Shelter.
Yeah.
Yep,
yeah.
They're not even
going
to take shelter because there's no way for them to transport safely all their kitties, so they're staying with their kitties because they are family.
Mm-hmm. Awful. You know, and but you understand it. I mean, that's what happened with Katrina, and it changed a lot of laws, you know, with a temporary, like a lot of people stayed behind because motels wouldn't open their doors to pets or gymnasiums or whatever. You know, it was like, no, you can't have your pet, and a lot of people stayed and lost their lives, you know.
It's true.
So,
yeah, I know Stephen wouldn't. Stephen wouldn't leave our two cats.
No. Yeah, yeah. I tell people this. I said I would take a bullet for my cats, and I'm not joking. I mean, I would do anything to protect them, and I'd go to the ends of the earth to and I have. And Collie can tell you. I mean, I've gone flat broke, tending to their health when they've been sick. I mean, and she's seen
and
it. Collie knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't even think. It's just like your paternal instinct kicking in, like, hey, this is my kid, and, you know, you just you don't think you do what you have to do to protect that which you love, you know, or as they always say, we serve that which we love.
That's true.
So, you know, God bless the people and the animals, you know. It's frightening.
Yeah, they're family. They are family in every way.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, that one day when you come to Imaginarium, we'll have to introduce you to Victoria and Albert because they allow us to bring them to the hotel there. So,
oh, really?
We can introduce you one day, hopefully.
Yes,
wow.
we bring them, and I bring them a litter box. I bring them everything, you know. We bring them there. So a lot of people come to our room to see the kitties.
Well, that's good to know because I might need to bring a dog with me.
Absolutely.
Well, they won't care. I think they charge like an extra $20 or whatever.
Yeah,
but
that's nothing.
I mean, it's worth it. You know, it's worth it if I can bring them with us. And that way we know they're taken care of. We can go see them. They don't have to be scared because we're there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. But, they're family. They really are.
Yeah.
Well,
and then
we're getting close to the end here. And
I don't
want to change subjects, but we're getting close to the end of the show, and we can go over. Sally Ann, hang in there.
Yeah, well, if we go over a little bit,
okay. And we'll keep recording.
We'll
keep recording.
Skinwalker.
yeah. But before we end the regular show ends, because it'll cut off like the chat room and stuff at 10:30, but we can go over and it'll still record. It'll record everything and it'll be available for playback in like 15, 20 minutes after the show, after we're done.
Yeah,
maybe
we don't lose
somebody
it.
Can listen to it. But I wanted to make sure that you've got your how to get a hold of you, Karen. And your books and all of that, if people want to reach out.
Yeah, well, my website is KarenFWilliams.com.
Okay, and that'll lead them to everywhere.
Yeah, my book, short stories, everything's on there, including a very unsettling short story called Monkey Business that you can read for free. It was published in Piff magazine not long ago, and there's a link to read it on there. So Karen F. Williams, all lowercase, KarenFWilliams.com, all one word.
Good deal.
Excellent. Nice site. I encourage people to go visit it. It's a great site. And, you can read about Coyote Blues, which I do want to mention, has received quite a few accolades. I mean, it's awesome to kind of read up on your awards, like Publishers Weekly had given it high praise. You won a Rainbow Book Award, finalist for the Golden Crown Literary Award, and, of course, an Imaginarium, Imaginarium's Imagine Award. So, you received quite a bit. Yeah, so
yeah.
It's gotten some nice praise from a lot of places. So check out her site, folks. You won't be disappointed.
Thanks.
Very much so. Very much so. So what got you started into shapeshifting, and how do you know Miss Sally Ann?
Oh, gee. You know, how I met Sally, it was in the stars. That I don't know how else to describe it. We were just meant to meet. Right, Sally?
Absolutely, yes. It was one of those, you know, moments when you meet somebody and you go, this is going to be someone that's in my life forever. Not only this one, but a whole lot of other lives that come after. And you just have that intuition about it.
Yes, we met at a literary conference. Actually, my book, As the Crow Flies, I was on your show talking about that about 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and that was up for an award. And Sally was we met at a writers' conference in Pittsburgh, and it was just like that feeling, like I feel like I've known you forever, and that I will know you forever. So it was just instant.
Wow.
And you guys know Sally anyway. She's warm and great.
Oh, yes.
Just like feel like you've always known her.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I would definitely vouch for you on that.
Her.
Yeah.
I'm
yes, she
her.
Is.
Yeah. It's kind
of
like,
one of my favorite people.
I love my friends very deeply. You guys know that. I'm always there for you, forever and ever.
We've got to get out there to see you, because I want to see these crystals. Because Karen, she lives in such a cool area, man.
And
I want to get
cool
out there and just see all the crystals laying around and the beauty and the lore. You know, and maybe see a shapeshifter. Would you like to share a story, a song maybe?
Yeah, I'll give you the
Sally, because you're living out there with the skinwalkers in the Southwest.
Yeah, she's got skinwalkers.
But, you know, before I don't have a whole lot to say about that. I'll just give you, like, the highlight of it. I wanted to say a couple of things that came to my mind as I was listening to this really great conversation you guys were having. One is, you know, shapeshift. Karen said animals are hunger-driven, and they are, but people are also hunger-driven, and they have bigger appetites, and that's where the trouble lies. Because in my mind, the animal species and the insects and all of nature around us are the superior beings, and we're just a bunch of crappers that come along and trash the planet and just don't. Get it. That's how I feel.
Yep.
When I live, this is very short.
Yeah, we're the disease.
Yeah.
We are. When we lived in Costa Rica for a bunch of years, the people would be trying to kill these bugs and tarantulas and scorpions and all this stuff. And a friend of ours who's Costa Rican said, what do you think? You live in the jungle. And it's like, you not only live in the jungle, you came along and leveled the jungle and stuck your houses here.
Right.
And we had troops of howler monkeys literally a foot and a half from our window in the trees. And, you know, yeah, it was great. But how great was it for those monkeys? Not very great. Because the people aren't like the animals. Animals are predictable in many ways in there. You know how to relate and how to make them happy and how to make them miserable, but people is so much more complex. So I just wanted to say that I think the key to shape-shifting is when you have that rage inside you that we all do, you know, some of us growl and make a lot of noise, and if you're from Brooklyn, like me, you curse a lot.
Wouldn't that be wonderful if you could do that? Be a vigilante and be like a
social
bear or wolf?
I want to. The shapeshifter to get rid of the bad humans. That's what I want to do. Rage plus that hunger. It's rage and hunger. Think about the Incredible Hulk. That's what it was. He got so angry and he was so passionate, so upset. and he had a hunger to make a change, and that's what a shapeshifter is, in my definition.
Yeah.
And so in Sedona, where I live, Sedona, a brief history on Sedona. It millions of years ago, Sedona was covered by sea. But civilization started around 8,000 B.C., and the original settlers were Paleo Indians, then there were Anasazi Indians, then the Hohokam Indians, and the Sanagua Indians, and the Navajo Indians, and across history all the way up until the 1900s, when Caucasian settler P.C. Schnevely and his wife, whose name was Sedona, came to Sedona. And they settled there.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually responsible to develop Sedona. He petitioned for a postal spot, and they agreed, yeah, we're going to give you a zip code, but we don't want a long name. And they kept rejecting all the names until one day his brother-in-law said, how about Sedona after your wife, who was loved by everyone? And that's Sedona.
Wow.
It's a spiritual mecca. It's out of control with energy. Shit happens here that doesn't happen anywhere else. Your hair sticks up, your body tingles, you know, you feel like you're walking through things that aren't visible to you. And below the red rock, very, very, is quartz crystal in abundance that all originated back to these millions of years ago. So quartz crystal is the master healer. It's one of the highest energy stones on the planet. So imagine when you're on these trails, you're walking over these areas, and literally in your feet, you put your hand in the ground and you scoop up crystals. And so that's the deal. And there's a history back more so to the native culture than it's not specific to Sedona, but in general to the native culture that dates back to early settlers, where shamans and medicine men, they would come into a supernatural realm to heal. And when they came in to heal, they were wearing skins of an animal, a bear, a wolf, other types of animals, each animal representing a different way to heal or a different problem to heal. And, you know, the shamans used it to transform themselves in part to that animal. Now, the back in the 1800s, a guy by the name of George Catlin made a painting of the famous shapeshifter, Skinwalker, who is depicted in many Native American pieces of art. So if you want to Google that, it's really kind of interesting. But it goes back to Blackfoot Medicine Man Skinwalker and the tradition of morphing into something else, pulling that energy out in an effort to heal a human, and also sometimes animals back then, because they cared more in a way about preserving animals in their natural state versus in captivity the way we are today. So that's my two cents on shapeshifting.
Well, and you know, even the and Viking, even though they didn't call themselves Vikings, we call them Vikings, but the Viking lore speaks of, they wasn't healers, they speak of berserkers, and that would be, you know, warriors that would actually, you know, shapeshift, you know, their mind and wear the pelt, like you were saying,
the bear,
they would wear
the
furs and the skins of animals. And Stephen, you can elaborate more on that too. But yeah, the berserkers were definitely shapeshifters.
Yeah, well, berserker literally means bear shirt, and or you could also say the Ulfhednar, which are the wolf coats. And if you look at the artwork and stuff, I mean, you can infer that they, you know, there might have been a belief that they actually transformed into something more than just a psychological thing. You know, and actually there was a shifting element in some of the legends and lore.
Element.
I've looked into that quite a bit and found that to be, you know, have some credence. So, yeah, absolutely.
So that's where the word berserk comes from.
Yes. Yeah, bear shirt. Bear shirt.
Going berserk.
You know, I have to tell you, Stephen, on the topic that I just finished reading, The Awakening.
Oh,
your story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
And I really like the series.
Appreciate that. I'm really honored.
I think you're.
He does a lot of research.
Oh my God! Well, first of
I work
all,
it in
well,
there.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say that sometimes, like high fantasy, I can't get into it because it always starts with like 20 characters, a war, or fighting, and
right.
Jim and Joe and Don, and it's like by chapter two,
you
it's
can't
like
keep up.
My bitty brain is like I don't know who's who, and I just
right.
I don't care if the people live or die because I don't even know who they are, you know. But with your stories, you always Stephen always brings in like two people at a time. Like you set the stage. I think you're a master of atmosphere. And then in terms and I know with high fantasy that it's usually, you know, plot driven. But I have to say in your case, I think it's as character driven as it is plot driven. And the landscapes are wonderful. With The Awakening, I just love the bog. I've always had,
yes.
I don't know, I've always had this, it's almost like the terrifying sublime, but I've always been enchanted and terrified of the idea of bogs. And I've done a lot of camping. I've spent a lot of summers in Maine and coastal Canada. And, you know, up in Canada, all the peat, that's where they get the peat, you know. And in England too, on the moors, but you know, Canadian, you know, peat. And I've read stories, like true accounts of people who, you know, you climb into this bog and you think you're just walking through the trees on moss, and it's like a trap, you know, where you just people have just gone down, and then the moss closes over
yeah.
you, and you drown under this. That you know. Anyway, so I was. It was just a real cozy read for me. With you know, the characters going into the bog after the reaver.
Oh yes, I guess some of that good old Celtic kind of lore. Yes,
and on top of that, the revenants, which we also call a lich. You know, a lich is the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because my new book is about a lich or revenant, just a living skeleton. But I thought that was the coolest thing to have all the corpses coming out of the bog. That was
it was creepy.
It was really creepy.
I love that the peat bog archaeology finds, and yeah, I just thought I'd have a little fun with that one, that part of it.
Yeah,
but that was a lot of fun. But thank you.
Yeah, it was a very, very along the lines of Lovecraft. You know, it was just really chilling, in a good way.
Well, thank you. That's fantastic. Wow, what a surprise. Appreciate that very much.
Instead of having, you know, the undead coming out of graveyards, it's like, you know, you didn't expect them to be coming out of the bog. And, so thank you for that.
Nice. You're welcome.
Yeah, so many stories you start, and it's just, you know, you always crave, like Sally, you talk about hunger. Sometimes you hunger for just that good book that you just can't wait to get home and get into bed and with your Kindle and finish, you know, like you just look forward all day returning to that story. And it just doesn't happen often for me, you know, Stephen's work. I love.
Yes, thank you. And I go ahead and say this. This is a little bit of serendipity, but that novella I referred to at the beginning of the show that I just finished does take place in the same world as Ragnar and Raiden, but it actually is inspired by a setting on the Four Corners region of the American Southwest, and I draw off of the Puebloan people, and it does.
Oh, wow.
I can either confirm nor deny that it does have a skinwalker in it. So.
Ah,
wow. Here we come full circle. Here we come full circle.
Yeah.
What timing?
Wow.
I've got one for you to read here very soon, Karen.
That.
Yes, yeah. you will like it. It's a distinct new character and set on the region with the Puebloans and the cliff dwelling kind of societies and going back in that kind of more of that ancient setting. That's where the inspiration comes from. Yeah, Rain and Ragnar are not a part of this. It's different. Different. Same time, same world, but different story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Great.
It's gonna be a lot of fun.
While we're on that subject, though, and I've got Karen and Sally Ann both here, and with Sally Ann living where she does, out there in Sedona, that landscape and all the lore and all the weird things that happens out there, the UFO sightings, the mystical elements, which we've got to visit because I've got to. Yeah. I just want to roll around in the crystals. Energy and draw up that good stuff.
We talk about this at least once every week or so, Sally Ann. We do. We actually, sitting here in the office, we'll say, we have got to find a way to get out to visit you.
Me too.
We talk about this all the time.
Yes,
all the time.
We all need to plan a trip, and it would be awesome. But I got to ask, what do you think about the Nephilim lore, and is there any Nephilim lore in like Sedona and in that area out there?
Or giants,
giants.
The giant people.
The Nephilim,
I just want to say this, Holly. I don't mean to get off track, but when you picked me up, which Karen missed that story in the beginning, when you said you picked me up when we first met each other in person.
I witnessed it.
And my feet, this is going to come full circle, Stephen. My feet are off the ground when your woman picked me up and swung me around. So
That's Holly.
I was so excited, and I'm like, oh, my God, Sally Ann, what day? I was in the office and come out because I heard her voice, and I come running out, and she's like, Holly, and I grabbed her and lifted her up off the ground and spinned her around because I am a giant, and it was magnificent.
It was the best hug of my life, Holly. I mean that. I've never been hugged like that before or after.
It was impressive. It was impressive.
There's more coming.
We were one of those commercials, like running towards each other until we collided, and he lifted me up. It was great.
That was too good.
Yeah, you got to come on out to Sedona because there's so much here. You won't even believe it. You know, even just to walk down the street, you're like, oh my effing God! I mean, we still do it all day, every day. Go to the supermarket, like, oh my God, look at this food. I mean, you cannot turn your eyes without thanking somebody for this incredible place. Come on out. I'm ready to host you. Let's go. I wanted to say one thing. I just go back to Coyote Blues and Riley. She was born with a tail. I personally think that if people had tails, we would dance way better because I've seen my dog shake her tail and the butt always goes with it. I've tried it on two legs and four, down on all fours, and it's not happening. So I'm all for a tail. I'm signing up.
Well, it helps with balance,
my demise,
right?
Balance, everything.
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
a dead giveaway, though. You know, start wagging when you're not supposed to wag it. That would be a problem.
And, you know, you talk about tails, Sally, but, you know, just quickly, not off the subject, but in another part, there is this series on Netflix that came out this past year called Aliens in Alaska. And one of the episodes, I forget. Yeah, there's only about like 7 episodes, and they're really so believable. But one episode that focuses on people who have seen animals that gave them like a really like some woman who's like now in her late 70s, and she talks about having seen this, you know, years ago. Like driving along the highway and braking because she saw the face of like an animal, and her instinct was to, you know, pull over and help it or move it to the side of the road. And as she got out, the way it looked at her, and then she saw, like, a tail that couldn't belong. Like, it didn't look like any animal that lived in Alaska. And something told her,
right,
do not get out of the car. You know, you have to watch it. And there's other,
yeah,
people who have seen, you know, and then, of course, it goes back to maybe they're aliens, you know, maybe Bigfoot. Maybe we never find a trace or a dead one,
mm-hmm,
because maybe that's like their astronaut suits that the aliens put on to collect things in the Canadian wilderness, you know, like,
mm-hmm,
maybe they,
mm-hmm,
need fur and to keep warm and, you know. And God, you know, even we're talking about religion and God, and, you know, really,
mm-hmm,
if you believe in God, then, I mean, he's an alien, isn't he? I mean, because he's not of this earth. He might have created it, but he's not of this earth. So, you know,
right,
technically, a
and
higher
he's not
power,
human, you know,
a higher intelligence is, you know, it's an alien intelligence. So,
right,
anyway, but it's a really good docuseries, and just a couple of episodes.
Well, I'll have to check that out. Yeah, because that's what I said. I don't shoot anything down. You know, I believe anything until I'm proven different, you know. There's people swear they see fairies. Well, you know, there probably is fairies. I want to see one. I can't wait to see a fairy, you know, if they're out there. I want to see one, but, you know, I'm not going to just say there's not fairies because a lot of people say they see them.
Sally sees them all,
mm-hmm,
the time.
My
nice.
Wife
I know.
My wife was the biggest skeptic. I can get her and she'll verify, but she's probably sleeping. She's like, Sally, you have spirits and you're people in flowing gowns and these fairies and, oh, my, the black hat guy. Really? Come on, you know, it's static electricity. And like 2 weeks later, oh, my God, there's fairies in the kitchen. Oh, my God, every time I come in the kitchen, there's fairies. Oh, there's a fairy again. Did you see the fairy that just passed in front of the TV?
Mm-hmm.
Then I go, oh, Mickey, you and those fairies.
Yeah. Remember what you said? I don't
know.
I just didn't realize.
Yeah, it could be the psychological isolation of COVID, but, you know, it's like...
Maybe. I don't know.
But it could be real.
I've had a lot of shit happen in my house.
The way I look at it, you have unconnected cultures all around the world, in the ancient world. In the ancient world, you have unconnected cultures that all have similar lore in a lot of areas.
Yes.
And
yeah.
The cultures that did not interact with each other in the ancient world, and they all came up with very similar things that were part of their world. And, you know, I mean, think about that. Yeah, it's something to really, you know, think about.
That's it. There's something to it.
Yeah.
Shape-shifting. That's what's said, from the Vikings to here. Come on now. You know, and it goes back way before there was any explorers here. You know,
sure,
fairies,
giants, dragon lore. I mean, you can go down the list. There's stuff that has commonality.
And it's like identical.
Over.
It goes back to Joseph Campbell and just that mono myth that we all, every culture has the same characters,
mm-hmm,
the same sightings, the same, you know, creation myths and destruction myths and almost like it ties into the, what is it called? The Akashic records.
Yeah, the Akashic records.
Yes.
Yeah, in the astral world. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
For
yep.
some reason,
mm-hmm,
no matter where we are, people will see or experience or have the same ideas or what, you know, at the same time.
Right.
Or at least,
right.
At least that's how.
And
I
now
understand
there's
it.
People since the social media age has come about. And people can talk more now. I mean, we are connected to anyone, anywhere around the world at our fingertips. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We can talk to, if we want to talk to someone in Pakistan or, you know, Turkey, or it don't matter, wherever you want to talk to somebody, you can nowadays, and get their view and perspective on things. And with that comes a lot of eye-opening topics and discussions, but the one that's it's common theme now is people are finding out things that we believe that a whole bunch of us know to be true and have memories of that a whole other generation doesn't have any memory of.
Yeah.
You know, just like, what was it last night, Stephen, I was showing you? There's that whole thing about the Bernstein Bears. When we were kids, it was the Bernstein Bears, Berenstein. That's what we called the Berenstein. And now they're trying to say, no, they've always been the Bernstein.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, they wasn't.
They
wasn't.
That is fascinating. Yeah, that is fascinating. That's some wild stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm like, no. No, they wasn't.
Sounds like another show.
But now that...
to another show. We could do another show on this, with those
like
kind of things.
Show.
It's so true. We could go into that whole
so
thing. Because,
so much out there.
The mystical world. And,
You know, and
it is
neat in the next 20 years, what we're going to see.
Yeah.
Arizona's the Wild West. And especially in this area, Sedona, a lot of people throw ashes. Thousands upon thousands of people, including one day my own, will be thrown on Bell Rock and the surrounding vortexes. So there's a lot of spirit life here. But, you know, if you're walking down the street and you turn your head and in a split second you see a wagon train pulling horses, that you saw that spirit, unless you happen to be thinking about, I watched a John Wayne movie last night and I'm thinking about it.
Right.
That's a memory.
Right.
You know, but if you're just waiting in line at the hardware store and you look out the window and there goes, you know, clunkety clunk with horses in the cart, you know, you saw something, and there's a lot of that here too.
Exactly.
Sure.
That's why I will have so much fun out there. I will have to do a lot of meditating and a lot of ready, because I will be overwhelmed. They'll be like, blah, 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 you know, because the spirits are always blah, 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 you know, in my ear.
Yeah.
And I'm like, shh, you know, if y'all get, you know, take your turn. I'm not dealing with you all right now. One come through at a time. Yeah.
Well,
that's going
to
be interesting.
Holly.
A friend of ours said the same exact thing that you just said, Holly. She came into our house, and after a few minutes, she laid on the floor. I think I told you this story once before. And, and she's like, I can't take this house. There's so much going on. The noise. There's so many spirits in this house.
Yeah.
And she literally
that sounds like Holly.
Spent the visit on her back on the floor until she had some
peace.
It's crazy.
Yeah, because you can't – you learn to block that out. I mean, because, you know, I've had this ability – all my life, it never, like, just come on at a certain age. I've been this way my whole life, you know, and I've learned over the years, you know, how to turn it off and not, you know, let it overwhelm me. But, yeah, highly active areas like that, it's a lot. It's a lot to deal with. You really have to be centered before you enter an area like that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have that. I don't have that. I'm not tapped into that, but boy, I would love to do it. Love to be able to manifest that. So, although I can imagine after a while, it gets you.
Yeah, it's exhausting. It's exhausting.
Right. Yeah,
especially
so you have
we'll
to be like
grocery store,
enough.
You know, and I'll tell Stephen, well, their granddaughter is following them around, or their grandmother's following them around, or, you know, they've got this following them around, because I, you know, I see them, and they'll pass me by, and sometimes they'll turn their head to recognize me or whatever, you know, they know I could see them, and they'll smile, or I'll get, you know, something from them. But, yeah, I mean, it's just all over. But there's times where I'm just exhausted. I got that all, you know, turned off, and I'm like, no, I'm not dealing with you right now. No.
Yeah.
Because it is overwhelming. What was she going to ask,
like having...
Karen?
No, because I was going to ask, I know that you know, professionally, that your focus is on holistics, but is it, what do you do?
Well,
I mean, what,
don't
what
do any Reiki
like,
or nothing like that. I don't do any mystical work as far as that is because, well, I have fibromyalgia and a whole bunch of health issues myself. And if I would attempt to try to do all that, I'm going to make myself very sick taking that all in. And I just don't think it's a good idea. But
well, it's like energy zapping,
holistically,
right? Holistically, I mean, because it's energy zapping.
It is. It is. And it's draining, you know, and I just don't think it'd be good for me personally. Mm-hmm. I love Reiki. I've had it done on me, and I could say it does work. It truly does. It's a transfer of energy. Holistically, I am very much into essential oils, diffusing. I make body products. I make healing salves, organic, natural healing salves, utilizing essential oils, pain salves, body butters, things like that that you would need. I'd put my healing salve against the Neosporin any day. Steve knows that. It does work. You know, I always say God-made is better than man-made any day. I'll take nature.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you sell it? Do you sell your product?
Yeah, I believe in using as much as you can of the energies around us. So using your plants for medicinal. There is times, I'm not saying if you cut your leg off or whatever, don't go to the ER. Of course you go to the ER. You know, if natural things aren't healing you and you've got a really bad infection and aren't no better in like a week or something, go to the doctor. Of course you do.
Sure.
Use common sense. You know, I'm not saying you just pray it away or whatever, but, you know, you can tap into, you do have a lot, your mindset, your mind over matter, it is true, because if you keep a positive outlook, and I have trouble sometimes, we all do, you know, we're not all positive all the time, you know, we're just not, we all have our ups and downs, ebbs and flows, but if you try to keep that positive outlook or think, you know, I'm going to do this today and I'm going to be happy today, and you make that conscious choice, you can feel better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even if you're sick, you know, you can feel better. If you're really focusing on it and you let it overwhelm you and like drown your emotions, then you're going to be sicker. It your mind truly can help heal you. And it does. And then with the use, like I said, of herbs and plants and, you know, all that matter, utilize what you've got, especially locally. I'm really big on like local honey and stuff like that. Yeah. Because it's your environment. It's what you're used to. It's what you're around. You have less allergy to things around you. So utilize, you know, local as much as you can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good advice.
But yeah, I'm big over mind over matter. And like I said, you know, it is hard. I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody of being negative. Stephen knows I say I'm a realist because.
Yeah, me too.
Stephen said,
I know.
You know,
I understand.
Oh, that's negative. But I'm like, no, I'm a realist. I see people for what they are. I am an empath too. So it's fun being a clairvoyant, an empath, especially in a crowd of people. That's why at Imaginary, I sneak away every once in a while because I have to get, you know, recentered, and it gets exhausting.
Sure.
But then I get back out there and I'm all extroverted, you know, and having a ball. But it is a burden and a curse to be empathetic with people and feel their emotions. Yeah. But people can't always be happy all the time.
I always think of myself as an introvert who does well socially.
That's me.
Yeah. But you know what?
I don't care to be alone.
Yeah, but you know, introverts kind of do better because they like their own company, you know? Whereas, you know, real extroverts get depressed if they're home alone and they don't have an audience or they don't, you know, they don't have feedback from other people. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, those of us who tend toward introversion are a little better stocked emotionally to just, you know, reflect and spend time, you know, alone. Or even, you know, when you're living with someone and, you know, you're sharing the same physical space, but psychologically you can both be sharing separate spaces, you know, which is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Me and Steve do, because, like, all day we're working, and he's got his thing going, I got my thing going, And, you know, we meet in the middle of sometimes when I got to ask him something or he asks me something. But, I mean, psychologically, he's got his own stuff going. I got my own stuff going. He's got his own music, news things he watches, whatever, articles he's reading. I'm doing something on my own. You know, we have all that. We spend time together, you know, like before we go to bed and stuff, we'll read or watch TV or whatever. But, yeah, during the day, we're like two separate, you know, individual people going about their way.
And that's good, you know.
And I'm happy to be by myself. I mean, that doesn't bother me. And I always say, if you cannot stand your own company, then you need to look inward. There's something going on. You need to soul search.
Absolutely.
Not everyone can admit that.
True.
They think not every. They think they like their company, but they don't really. You know, being human is hard to do.
No, that's definitely not easy. All right.
I had too many kids. I like peace and quiet now. It's fine with me.
That's not bad. Not bad. Yeah.
Yeah, when the grandkids come, it's great. But when they leave, you know, it's like. Peace and quiet. But this has been a great show, girls. I tell you what.
Yes, thank you so much.
No, thank you. No, thank you. This has been a great.
Sally, did you want to serenade us out?
Oh, my God. Do you want me to? I ran out of water a half hour ago, so my lips
do
are
it, do it, do it.
I'll do a few bars. How's that? Okay.
All right.
You know,
all right.
I'm sorry, Steve.
Say something fast.
The day, bidet.
No, that's all right.
Did you say play something fast?
Yeah, do something like up tempo.
What was that?
Up tempo.
Well, I have this song I practiced, so now you're stuck with it, but I'll try to play it fast. How's that?
Okay.
Is that okay?
Play it up. All right.
I'll play a somewhat slow song. I'm demented, so sometimes I start it slow, it goes fast, then it goes backwards and in reverse. Gonna find out, pretty mama, what turns on your light. Calling and the fever's high, and the wicked wind whispers and moans. You got your demons, you got your desires. I got a few of my own. Yeah. Ooh. Someone to be kind to in between the dark and the light. Ooh, I'm coming right behind you. Well, I'm gonna find you one of these nights. There you go.
Hey.
Yay!
Virgin.
I remember that song.
And my lips are still stuck together. You do remember that song.
Of course.
She's the only one that shows up in my...
Was it Atlanta Rhythm Section?
No, that's the Eagles in 1970.
Oh, that's right.
Off of their... one of these nice albums. It went to number one that album on Billboard.
Right.
Yeah, I know. It does count. It went.
That was
that's
a good song.
I played it fast.
Yeah.
I screwed you up. I played it fast.
Yeah.
If I played it slow, you would have said, oh, that was the Eagles.
I know you can't make it to Imaginarium this year, Sally Ann, but next year you've got to sing a song for me. I mean, you've got to, either during the word ceremony or during opening ceremonies or something. We'll figure it out, but you got to sing a song.
You know, my heart's in Kentucky, Holly. I want to be there. I hope I can be there.
I know.
Year. I want, you know, and Sunspot, that group that writes their own ghost story songs. I love those guys. They're amazing.
Yes.
Met them at,
they're fun.
Met them at your awesome. Yeah.
They're
all
fun.
Right, well,
and so much has changed since you've been there. I mean, we have grown by leaps and bounds.
Oh, I know.
We're in this fantastic new venue. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Right.
And, you know, it's just amazing. We got our restaurant, bar. Everything's right there, handy.
Cool.
And it's,
yeah,
it's glorious.
That's awesome. And you know what? My hair looks,
yeah,
great in Kentucky. Because it's always great,
mm-hmm,
in the desert. And Mickey always says, why is,
mm-hmm,
your hair curly on the East Coast? Why is it straight here? Like, I don't know. I'm going back to Kentucky.
The humidity.
I had the best hair in Kentucky.
That's true.
You are always, you are always welcome in Kentucky.
You are always welcome. Yeah, absolutely.
Ditto, ditto, my friends. I love you guys. Thank you for having me in.
And Karen,
you've
got to come see us. I tell you, you'd have a blast.
You'll have fun.
You know, Sally and I were talking about that too, because I was like, "All right, Kentucky, but it's July, and I have to drive because I do have to take an animal or two with me." But anyway, we're going to work that out, me and Sally.
Oh, fantastic!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah.
Keynote. She's got a lot to say. People will be all over that.
And our venue has great air conditioning,
so
don't worry about the heat. Don't worry about the heat.
No.
Yeah.
Last year it was mild. It was actually mild, so I'm hoping. But,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it stays nice and cool inside. And everything's there. You don't even have to leave. I mean, there's restaurants and everything all around, but there's an awesome restaurant right there. Plus, I have them serve food, you know, closer to the vending areas and stuff,
uh-huh,
all day. And we've got the bar.
Great.
We got everything we need.
Great. Sounds wonderful.
It's a great
We'll work
time.
On it. Right, Sally?
A lot of fun. Absolutely. It's great. A lot of fun.
Heck
really good conference. We might
and I will pick Sally Ann up and give her one of my famous hugs right in front of you. You got to see it.
Yes.
I'm waiting for it, Holly.
Oh, my.
All right.
This is great.
All right, guys.
Thanks for a great
time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right.
You take care.
All right.
Great
so
conversation.
Have you, back soon.
You too. Stay well.
Okay. Take care.
All right.
Bye, Daniel.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I didn't even talk to you tonight.
Bye, okay. Girls.
Bye.
He got disconnected.
Bye.
But, yes.
Okay.
Good night. Well, thank you, everybody, checking in tonight on the Star Chamber Show live podcast. And next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, we'll have a great show in store for you, just like we did tonight with Karen F. Williams and Sally Ann Monty. So, Daniel, unfortunately, tech glitch got disconnected from us toward the end of the show. So, Holly, you'll have to take us out and close it out.
Oh, well, that's a lot on my shoulders. Daniel always has some really brilliant, you know, things to add and take us out with. So now you're stuck with me, but I will say, join us next week, same time, 9 Eastern Standard Time, at this same great place, Blog Talk Radio, the Star Chamber Show. Tell your friends, tell your family, bring one, bring all. Don't forget, you could join the chat room by just clicking on the link that we share around all through social media. We also have a Facebook page, the Star Chamber Show podcast, that you can check out that we will, you know, post about next week's show as it gets closer. And you click that link, you can come right through to the chat room. If it doesn't load the first time, you know, just reload it. And we'd love to hear from you. We'll take your questions, whatever. You could also call in using the number, the 4616 ending number at the top once you click that link, and ask your questions. Or if you have a tidbit you'd like to add, if you'd like to be a guest, let us know. And stay creative. And we will catch you next week. Have a wonderful week, guys. Bye-bye.